What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. As the date for transfer of power in Iraq gets closer, the violence there has picked up this week, with scores of Iraqis killed in suicide bombings over the past 2 days. From the distance of the United States, it can be hard to judge what's really going on behind those headlines. Filmmaker Martin Smith has gone beyond Baghdad, down dusty backroads, and behind the closed doors of American command centers to bring home footage of a country at an excruciating crossroads. Tonight on Point, we drive across Iraq for an intimate look at a land teetering between hope and chaos with our guide, documentary filmmaker Martin Smith. We begin tonight in Baghdad, where a second suicide bombing in 24 hours has killed at least 47 people at an Iraqi army recruitment center. The explosion brought the two-day death toll to 100 Iraqi lives after a similar bombing Tuesday south of Baghdad. Edward Wong covers Iraq for the New York Times. I asked him what U.S. officials are saying about who may be responsible for today's deadly attack.
Well, they're saying that they're not sure exactly who did it. No one's claimed responsibility. As in all of these suicide car bombings, U.S. officials say they suspect that this is the work of foreign terrorists, but that's all speculation at this point. They don't have any evidence to support that. And so it's really anyone's guess as to who really is perpetrating these bombings right now.
Ed, can you paint a picture of the locale at which this bombing took place?
Today's bombing took place right in the center of Baghdad at a place called the Muthanna Military Air Base. And that's sort of an abandoned air base that Saddam Hussein and his government once used as a military depot point. But in the last several years of his regime, he started to build a large mosque there that was never completed. And then when the American military invaded, they basically took over that area. And then the new Iraqi army that the American government is forming is using part of that area for a recruiting station. And basically, there was a long line of people. I think the estimate is more than 100 people were waiting in line this morning basically to apply for jobs with the new army when the white Oldsmobile sort of careened into the area and exploded.
Is there a free flow of traffic in this area, or had this car made it through checkpoints?
The line of people, as I understand, is stretched out through the road, so I don't think that there were any checkpoints in particular around that road because they were sort of outside the security perimeter. Which was also the case in Iskandaria yesterday at the police station bombing. They were job applicants who stretched outside of the barriers of the police station, and so it was easy for a car to drive right up and detonate itself.
Ed, you had the day to talk with Iraqis after this very large explosion. What kind of responses have you been hearing to this back-to-back bombings in Iskandaria and Baghdad?
I was down in Iskandaria yesterday, and one thing that really surprised me was the hostility of the onlookers to the American presence here. There was a very large crowd gathered near the police station that had been bombed, and they were chanting anti-American slogans, and they were blaming the Americans for the attack. They said that American fighter jets fired missiles at the station, which is a refrain you hear often at these bomb sites, this sort of conspiracy theory of American jets shooting up the police. And at one point, the mob sort of rushed towards the Iraqi police chief who was visiting, and American soldiers had to raise their M16s and point it at the mob in order to get it to disperse. And then the police chief jumped into his car and raced off towards Baghdad. And later on, after the American soldiers left, the mob sort of rushed the police station, and policemen had to fire their guns into the air to disperse the crowd. So it was a very very hostile and very violent reaction to the bombing, and very anti-American too, and which shows sort of the level of trust or confidence that the people, at least in that town, have towards the American occupation here.
Right or wrong, what is the logic of that anger, of those conspiracy theories?
there's a lot of different reasons for that. And part of it is that a lot of Iraqis don't like their country being occupied. Even the ones who supported the overthrow of Saddam feel that they can do without the Americans now and that they would like to rule their own country. And in the large parts of the Middle East in general, there has always been this animosity towards the Americans, and they conflate the sort of American foreign policy with support of Israel and anti-Arabism. So there's this entire culture of sort of American conspiracy theory that goes on here throughout this country and throughout the Middle East. Also, under Saddam, people lived in a world where sort of misinformation as well as trafficking in all kinds of sort of shadowy theories was common because of the lack of open media or open news media during that regime.
The occupation authorities have been trying to build up the Iraqi police force and new military as fast as possible. Are events like this cutting into their ability to bring in new recruits, new employees?
It's hard to tell what kind of effect this will have because we're hearing different things from people we interview. And obviously, our interviews aren't scientific surveys or polls. I mean, we hear, for example, in Iskandaria, I was in the hospital and interviewed some people who have been injured in the attack, people who were either applying for jobs or policemen at the site, and they said that they were determined to either become policemen or to remain on the police force. And a colleague of mine who was at the site today in Baghdad said some people told him the same thing. Yet there are a few people who do say that they don't feel safe working for the police because of this, or that they would not work for the police or the army for fear of their own safety. So it's really hard to tell what kind of long-term effect or even short-term effect this will have. The country is in desperate need of security forces. For example, in Baghdad, there's around 9,000 police officers right now, and one American general says the city needs 10,000 more just to maintain sort of a minimum acceptable level of security.
And finally, the threat of sectarian warfare was raised this week in these supposedly intercepted documents headed for al-Qaeda, asking for al-Qaeda's help in sparking a civil war in Iraq. We've heard Iraqis themselves expressing concern about civil conflict. What did these bombings, have they had any sectarian face or interpretation?
No, actually, looking at where the bombings have occurred, they don't seem to be effort to start up a civil war or an ethnic or a religious war. In the past, there have been bombings of police stations. Attacking police stations is a fairly common tactic used by the insurgents or terrorists or whatever you want to call the attackers.
Ed, thanks very much for joining us. Be safe.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Edward Wong is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Baghdad. Tonight on Point, we're taking a drive across Iraq with documentary film producer Martin Smith, who's traveled Iraq's city streets and back roads to the mosques and public squares and meeting rooms where the future of Iraq is being shaped. What's the movie in your mind of what's going on in Iraq? After all that's happened, has Iraq become real for Americans, for you, or is it still a distant blur? As we drive tonight, what do you hear in the voices of American soldiers, in the voices of Iraqis living without certainty? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is award-winning film producer Martin Smith. His film Beyond Baghdad airs tomorrow night on the PBS documentary show Frontline. Good evening and welcome, Martin Smith.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us, and thank you for your work in Iraq. You spent 5 weeks in a secondhand BMW with an entrepreneurial driver out of Baghdad, I guess, driving really from north to south right through this country. What it was your third trip back to Iraq since the war, Martin. What did you go for? What were you looking for this time?
Well, we were looking for what we would find. We had been told by Ambassador Bremer on a previous trip that the press wasn't doing a good enough job of getting out and about and seeing all the other stories outside of all the killing and bombings that were going on in Baghdad. And, you know, that was the premise of this film, to take him up on that and travel the length of the country. We came in over the Turkish border and for 5 weeks zigzagged our way down south and left through Kuwait. But I don't know that I can say that that we were looking for anything other than what we would encounter. Obviously, I was looking for smart people with experience on the ground who could tell me what was going on in the various places. And I already had a sense that each region of Iraq had its own story, had its own unique set of problems. So we were looking to highlight those and make them understandable for people.
Well, what you found, I found very illuminating, having watched a tape last night. Everybody can watch it tomorrow on Frontline. But there are pictures here that really filled out the picture for me, both from the perspective of American officers and soldiers who are struggling with these enormous challenges there, and from the many perspectives of Iraqis, of many stations and sects, and how they're looking at things. I guess the overwhelming theme that came up to me, Martin Smith, was the fragility of this country, not just around infrastructure, which we've heard about again, but the sectarian violence possibility, the civil war possibility, which has always been raised as a bogeyman that I had the sense of being somewhere out there more distant. Even though this film came from November, and already then it felt like a very tangible concern, fear, possibility.
Yeah, we ran into that everywhere we went, and we heard that from officers, people who had supported the war, officers, U.S. military officers who were perhaps dubious that the war was a good idea in the first place. They also expressed this growing fear that of instability, fragility, as you say. And we heard it from Iraqis of all stripes. There's a real concern. It's not just – it's sectarian between Sunnis and Shias. It's also ethnic between Turkmen or Kurds and Arabs. So there are a number of fault lines that, as one officer told us in Kirkuk, that's a place that could unravel the whole place.
Even now.
It's so fragile.
We're going to try and hear a lot of sound tonight from the film. We don't have the images, but we'll use our imaginations here, and the sound brings it to light. I want to get a quick clip of General David Petraeus. You met him in the north, in Mosul. I think he's actually rotated home this week, but he has been large and in charge of a big chunk of Iraq since the war.
Yeah, he's done a great job.
He's going
back to Fort Campbell, Kentucky this week.
Finally coming home for a well-deserved rest. Here he is talking about what they're up against, and then there's a little bit of him in a kind of space-age-looking command center surrounded by PowerPoint charts and all kinds of electronics and row on row of officers listening. Here's David Petraeus in Mosul.
About a month or so ago, we saw a sustained spike of enemy activity. We've lost a number of soldiers during that time, had a number of others wounded. If the enemy sees this as an example of success, then, of course, they're going to want to take it on, and they are.
At the end of each day, General Petraeus joins his general staff for the evening briefing.
The other four were trying to gain entry through a non-border crossing location, sir.
It was a PowerPoint extravaganza.
Yes, sir. So
hundreds of reconstruction projects were reviewed.
Okay, next slide.
The 101st, I thought, runs a very tight ship.
You betcha. Okay, next slide.
Martin Smith there narrating from the Frontline documentary Beyond Baghdad, and there with a picture of a crowded row-on-row command center where General David Petraeus is reviewing the daily report of incidents, row-on-row of that jarhead, shaved-head American, practically, officers reporting in. It looks very crisp, very professional, very on top of things.
It blew me away. It blew me away. That room looked like something out of Houston.
NASA. NASA command center.
You had about, 100 officers in there, all with their own laptops. And each one, you know, had spent some part of the day preparing some kind of slide for this, as I say, PowerPoint extravaganza. And it all gave a very seductive sense of being in control. And I don't want to take away from the fact that they do run a very tight ship. The 101st has done a lot of things better than other units, other divisions in the country. But at the end of that briefing, it was brought home to me very clearly how fragile that is when a RPG was fired at a helicopter over Mosul, just as the meeting was coming to an end, and they had 17 soldiers killed.
And it wasn't the first time I saw clearly in your trip down through Iraq that you would be in the middle of talking with an American officer, and in would come the whispered word, ambush, trouble, helicopter down. I mean, the presence of violence in these interviews, in these scenes, is palpable.
Yeah, it's you don't have to be there long to cross its path. I mean, it's a dangerous place. There's no getting around it. I was speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Drinkwine down in the Fallujah, really a very dangerous place. And right in the middle of the interview, the fellow came in, interrupted, said, we have a We have a chopper down.
And there it was. We're taking a drive across Iraq tonight through the alleyways and mosques in a land teetering between hope and chaos with Martin Smith. His Frontline documentary is Beyond Baghdad. You can join the conversation. What's the movie in your mind of what's going on in Iraq today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking a drive tonight across Iraq through the alleyways and mosques of a land teetering between hope and chaos, between a tolerable future and civil war. Behind me, you can hear some of the tape from a new Frontline documentary entitled Beyond Baghdad. Producer of that documentary, Martin Smith, is with us tonight. He spent 5 weeks driving across Iraq. He's brought home some tape that really brings the country and its troubles to life. There's a lot we're going to talk about. That scene was in Kirkuk, where I believe, Martin, these were Shiites who were not happy with the balance of power on the city council. But before we get to Kirkuk, and you've got some good tape from an American officer there, I want to flip back to a wealthy Iraqi owner of a tannery. I believe this was in Mosul. Am I right?
Yeah, Muhammad Ali Yunus, a very wealthy man with a long family history of being in the tannery business.
And you took us with your cameras through that tannery where the hides are being readied for shoes and belts and whatever else that will be made of them. But he's also opening this internet cafe and, I don't know, leather souvenir shop, hoping to sell to
American
soldiers.
It was a combination laundry. Yeah, you can do your laundry there while you're on the internet, buy a leather jacket and have a hamburger.
Now, he had invested the equivalent of $40,000, a big investment in the future of Iraq. But as you spoke to him, it was clear that it was premised on U.S. forces sticking around. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. He said he would leave tomorrow if the U.S. forces left. He says there's a civil war, that everybody would be at each other's throats, you know, between Kurds and Arabs and Turkmen, Assyrians, Christians. He is investing because he's confident that the Americans are going to stay. Some of his friends, he told me, are contractors on the at the airbase next door, the U.S. airbase, mm-hmm. and he says they're building swimming pools and gymnasiums there. So I know they're going to stay, and so as long as they're going to stay, I'll invest.
But his nightmare scenario, if they should go, let's hear a little bit of Muhammad Ali Yunus in Mosul.
You know, I have a sense, I have a feeling that this is going to be something like a new Iraq, and that what you have seen back there is the old Iraq.
So you're investing a lot here?
Yes, we're very optimistic for the future.
But only if the Americans stay?
Oh, definitely. If the Americans leave now, it's a disaster. Here we have the elements of a civil war, of a terrible civil war.
So Kurds versus Arabs?
Shiites versus Sunni, Muslims versus Christians, Turks, Turkmenis versus Kurds, and you name it, we've got it. We're talking chaos.
Factory owner Muhammad Ali Yunus investing in a future with American soldiers around, sounding hopeful about that, sounding immediately and viscerally frightened of the idea of those soldiers going away, Martin Smith.
You know, but he said that he thinks the Americans are also going to stay because they came for the oil, and they're not going to let it go. And he thought it was a good idea that the Americans had come there for the oil. He's happy that they did. But
was that the
that
line that you got from American officers that you talked to? They seem to be so consistent in the way they approached your questions, which is not to say that they weren't thoughtful. They did seem thoughtful, but there's a very consistent kind of determination, a kind of a steady perspective that I assume comes down from on high. But what did they say about how long they expected American troops to be in Iraq?
Well, first of all, they have to, and I think we can all understand that if you're engaged in a project, you have to believe in it. It's just impossible to get up in the morning and go to work if you don't. You can know that you have problems with your project or whatever, and these guys know that they've got big problems, but they believe in it. Their perspective is, and I think there's a big misunderstanding, I think a lot of Americans think that we're going to hand over sovereignty and somehow we're going to be leaving. The fact is that we're staying. We're staying for an indeterminate time period, and it's simply going to be formally not an occupation anymore, but we're going to be there as guests, as invited, like troops in South Korea or Germany, let's say.
And yet,
theoretically, I don't think in practice it will work quite that way.
We'll talk about that, but there was always this sense with the officers you talked to that something is going to change on June 30th, that their authority will not be the same as it has been with this transfer of sovereignty. Am I right in that?
Well, it would work, you know, if we were able to withdraw to bases away from the cities and turn over security to Iraqi police or an Iraqi army. But there's a real question as to whether or not those institutions are going to be standing come June.
June. Mm-hmm.
And so I don't quite see how this is all going to work. And I think that the military knows they're going to have to continue to play an active role, some kind of patrolling, even though they're trying to reduce it, and some kind of ongoing training.
You drove south from northern Mosul, Kurdish territory, to Kirkuk, traditionally Kurdish, but a city oil-rich where Saddam Hussein had many, many Arabs brought in, displacing many Kurds. And here's where we first really begin to run into this sectarian Shia versus Sunni Kurd versus Sunni Kurd versus Arab tension in this case. You talked with Colonel Bill Mayville of the 173rd Airborne in Kirkuk, and let's listen to him talk about the complexity of his task in trying to hold this city together.
This is a place that could unravel Iraq. This is a place that could begin a downward spiral. Civil unrest is right here. It's at the surface.
How well does Washington or even Baghdad understand what you're facing here in Kirkuk?
First off, let me say, no one can possibly hope to appreciate the complexity of Kirkuk until you've been here and you've spent as much time as we have had the privilege of spending here. My concern at this point is that one community sees itself being outmaneuvered by the other, takes steps to make sure it's not outmaneuvered, and then we create this momentum that consumes the city at a rate and a pace that upsets the other community. The Kurds believe that the war really was about their repatriation to lands that they had lost during the Arabization process of Saddam Hussein. And they believe that there is a contract between the coalition themselves that for their support of us, we will underwrite their return to this province.
So there's American Colonel Bill Mayville of the 173rd Airborne, essentially in charge of occupation forces in Kirkuk. And you can hear Martin Smith, as you clearly did in his voice, this and in his words, this concern that things could get out of hand at a rate and pace that would be very hard to keep a lid on.
He's really a remarkable man, but he's not the only remarkable officer I met. He's one of the ones that we were able to interview, but I've met many very thoughtful officers like himself. And what was interesting, when you listen to this guy talk, he is also saying these same things to Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld and senators and congressmen when they come through Kirkuk. He's the head guy. He's the guy they brief. I said to him at one point, I said, so it's got to be sobering for Paul Wolfowitz to hear some of this stuff. And he agreed.
Very sobering. I mean, the images from the streets and the sound that we heard just at the top of this segment, but the tension is palpable. You talk with Arabs and Kurds who clearly are ready to go at it if they feel things are turning just the wrong way or the opportunity presents itself.
And they have gone at it. They've gone out into the streets with meat cleavers and muskets and whatever they could find. And the Americans have had to insert themselves in between them and stop Kurds from killing Turkmens or Arabs from killing Kurds. This has happened on at least three occasions. And the problem here is that all three groups think they have a right to the city, believe they have a right to the city, and all of them have a good case to make. But they don't want to and we're asking them to forget all this history and just sort of go from here. It's daunting, and they're not about to forget.
No, it's a very American idea, given how deep the history is there. And you saw repeatedly American troops in the middle of all this. I was struck by one scene where the troops are out in a village, perhaps it's near Kirkuk or further south, where a Saddam mural has been repainted since the invasion, and they're backing up a big vehicle to pull down the wall on which this mural is. You can hear them right here behind us. And down comes the repainted Saddam mural.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, you've got to wonder about that being the best use of troops. It makes sense to go into a village where there are people shooting and killing your soldiers. and arresting insurgents, and they did that, and we watched that, and they arrested people who had C4 explosives and rifles and banners proclaiming loyalty to Saddam. But running around and tearing down posters and murals, I think there's a question as to whether or not that's the appropriate role for the U.S. military to play.
And yet it seemed, at least in watching Martin Smith, that there's this visceral desire on the part of U.S. troops to see progress of some kind. As that mural comes down, it's hell yeah, says the GI there. It's something concrete when a mural comes down in a very muddy situation.
What would be more concrete would be to see Iraqis doing that. That would be concrete progress. There's no question that the Americans would like to pull down every poster of Saddam. But what we have to move to is getting Iraqis to share the vision. And that's in a town like that, that's the challenge.
As you drove further south, some remarkable scenes, a line of cars waiting for gasoline, which was just is astounding in its length. Your camera sweeps by for what feels like mile after mile, people waiting 6 hours, pushing their cars with their shoulders toward the pump. The inconvenience is quite incredible. And then you get to central Iraq, the Sunni triangle, where in the north, there's tension between Kurds and Arabs. Here, the tension, the animosity toward Americans, you feel it comes across very quickly as you drive into this territory.
Yeah. I mean, like I was saying, each part of the country has its own unique story. And when you get into the Sunni triangle, these are people who have traditionally had the power. Saddam was a Sunni. The British in the 20s empowered the Sunnis, left out the Kurds and the Shia. But these are the people now, as only one-fifth of the total population of Iraq, and that's a rough estimate, know that in a democracy, they're in trouble. And so they've turned their attention on the Americans. This is the heart of the resistance, the Sunni triangle. We went into Tikrit, the birthplace of Saddam, and some other places. And saw this kind of fear of what the future holds for them.
You talked with the commander of the 4th Infantry Division in Tikrit, talking about the prospects of the U.S. Keeping some kind of loyalty or respect of the people in the Sunni Triangle. Let's just listen to a bit of that. Here's another American commander speaking, this time in Tikrit, in the heart of Saddam Land in the Sunni Triangle.
We've come to ask the commander of the 4th Infantry Division, now headquartered here, about the prospect of winning the loyalty of the people in the Sunni Triangle.
Some of the problem is they expect the United States to come in, they would throw billions of dollars, and in 6 months, this country would be like Germany is today. That's an unrealistic expectation.
We had come here at a critical time. It has not been widely reported, but in October, reconstruction money, so important to winning hearts and minds, dried up.
We were just beginning to see people reacting to the successes we were having with the water treatment projects, with the school projects, with the sewage projects, with the police buildings and the courthouses being developed. We were really starting to see some positive response to all of that.
You had momentum.
We had momentum. And so we've somewhat lost that a little bit. We can regain it, but it's frustrating.
Why did nobody see that coming?
We didn't see it coming. I can't tell you why it happened. I don't know. So we just got to, it's done, it's water under the bridge, we got to move forward. I think that's my comment on that.
An American commander in Tikrit talking about resources running out as he was trying to rebuild there and the trouble of keeping the Iraqis there on his side from beyond Baghdad. Martin Smith's a new Frontline documentary. Paul is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. And first of all, I'm pleased to hear this description for the first time of the potential for civil war and chaos in Iraq. For example, if the United States military was not there. And, I mean, to me, it is relatively predictable, including the moving in of terrorism from the outside. Secondly, I haven't heard any real definition of, as of June 1st or so forth.
June 30. Mm-hmm.
June 30th. Well, that was conveniently moved, wasn't it? Anyway, of sovereignty for Iraq and who's in charge. U.S. military, has to be there for years, as we've said, and or bad results.
Yeah.
Now, who's in charge of the U.S. military? Iraq has sovereignty? What kind of sovereignty? And so there's a there's a wishful thinking here. There's some type of a political motivation to say something here, but there's no definition. And I guess if the U.S. military is there to maintain security or attempt to, the U.S. military is in charge. There is no sovereignty. In other words, I'm making it too extreme. Ends, but I don't.
No, but we get it. There's an ambiguity about how that's going to work out if you've got so many troops in the country, but yet you don't have sovereignty. How all that's supposed to work?
Ambiguity.
Paul, thanks for your observation and your call. Martin Smith, how about that? I mean, we read about Jerry Bremer, Paul Bremer, working feverishly toward this June deadline, though it's not even clear at this point exactly how what's going to lead to this transfer of sovereignty, caucuses or direct election. But what were these commanders expecting? And granted, this is a couple of months ago now, but what were they expecting exactly is going to happen? Are they really all going to hand over local authority to Iraqi councils, Iraqi mayors, and leaders?
Well, you're right to be confused about it. The administration, I believe, does not quite have this worked out. And if they do, they're not telling anybody. Your caller talks about wishful thinking. That is something that marks the last year of involvement in Iraq. Certainly the April, May, June period was we woke up to problems that hadn't been predicted because of wishful thinking, and we're likely to see that again. It is not clear how it is that Americans are going to continue to provide security and sovereignty is going to rest with Iraq. That has not been defined. Now, the UN has been called in to investigate the possibility of holding elections. There's great worry even about how to hold elections. You see 100 people die in recent bombings. How are you going to have polling places open and secure on election day? And you know, just imagine the chaos if there's bombings on those elections day.
And beyond those elections,
we're a long way from working out the formula here.
And yet, we're not a long way on the calendar. You listen to these extraordinarily conscientious U.S. commanders in the field. Did you have the sense that they're just planning on moving out of town when June 30 rolls around?
No, they can't. I mean, they have to patrol these towns; otherwise, these towns will devolve. And there'll be chaos. The U.S. presence is needed on the streets. I mean, they are experimenting now in Baghdad with getting patrols off the streets, and we'll see what happens. But I mean, I suppose we could go pull out. The American forces could pull out and bunker themselves up in the desert somewhere. But what's going to happen to the project that we've invested so much money in at that point if that's what we do? It doesn't quite make sense.
It sounds like it might quickly burn. We're talking tonight with filmmaker Martin Smith. His documentary Beyond Baghdad airs tomorrow night on Frontline. We're taking a drive with him across Iraq. You can join our conversation tonight. Is this a country coming together or falling apart? You can hear behind me Shia pilgrims in Kufa, a call and response prayer picked up by Martin Smith. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking a drive across Iraq tonight through a land teetering between hope and chaos. Our guide is Martin Smith, producer of the PBS Frontline documentary Beyond Baghdad, airing tomorrow night. He spent 5 weeks driving Iraq north to south. In the background here, you hear the sound of the south, or one corner of it, a mosque where the 30-year-old Imam Muqtada Sadr is being surrounded by the chants of his followers, God's army, with their green headbands and an awful lot of fervor. Martin Smith, we've heard in the north about the tensions between Kurds and Arabs in the Sunni triangle, the center of the animosity toward the American presence. When you got to the south, it was all about the Shia, their hopes, their dreams, their own divisions and fault lines. And the passion in that meeting that we just heard a clip of seemed extraordinarily high to me. Where is that headed?
Well, you know, this is a country where populists, whether they be Shia clerics or tribal sheikhs, can easily exploit these feelings. I mean, you've got high unemployment, you've got lots of random violence, you've got Americans in the view of the people failing to provide security. It creates a lot of anger. So there's a lot of opportunity for populists, and that's what Muqtada Sadr is. He's the son of a much-cherished, respected, late Grand Ayatollah, his father. He's taken charge of the mosque, and he gives a rousing anti-American sermon. He's challenged the other more moderate ayatollahs. He's pressuring the other ayatollahs the moderates to take a harder stand, and he's having some effect.
And what are these hundreds, thousands of supporters chanting as he sits before them in this open, largely open courtyard at the mosque?
Well, my Arabic's about as good as yours, unless you but I know from translators that they're chanting, "Long live Sadr." Sadr is winning. In that very scene that we just heard, they chant all sorts of things that sometimes anti-American chants are picked up. But it's quite a rousing sermon and meeting.
I was struck by your interviews with other Shiite leaders in the South who were reluctant to criticize Sadr and yet very clearly uneasy with his popularity and it seemed, with his message.
Yeah, for a long stretch of time now, they've struggled with how to keep him in a bottle. And he even went to Tehran at some point and conferred with some of the ayatollahs there. And there was talk about how when he came back, he was quiet for a while. But then he'll come out with a Friday sermon in which he's back at it. And he's had some notorious confrontations with some of the other ayatollahs over strategy. And when Sistani demands popular elections, he's backed by Sadr.
This is Ayatollah Sistani, who has asked for direct elections and not gotten
it. He's asked for direct elections. Mm-hmm. He's the preeminent senior cleric. He's 73 years old. What he says goes. He's the, you know, without dispute, the leader. But Sadr can apply pressure on him.
It was quite a moment when you stood outside Ayatollah Sistani's house, his office, I'm not sure which, in a very narrow alleyway, and you asked if you could come in to see him. And they said, look, Donald Rumsfeld doesn't get in here. Paul Bremer doesn't get in here. You don't think you're going to get in here?
Yeah. Wolfowitz has tried to meet with him, and Bremer has tried to meet with him. He is a recluse. He's been in there, that house and office. He lives there, I believe. For the last 6 years, there's reports that he's maybe never, if rarely, taken a step outside. Right now, he's afraid for his safety. There are people that would like to kill him. Some Sunnis would like to kill him.
And to stir the pot, to spark perhaps that civil war.
Absolutely. He's a powerful leader, too. I mean, there is no separation of church and state in Islam. So a spiritual leader like Sistani is a political leader.
There's another bit of tape I don't want to miss here. It's yet another American commander, this time a woman, Lieutenant Susan Grieg. Now, this is not quite this far south, but she picks up a theme that we heard earlier about the lack of resources for these American commanders struggling to bring change, to bring improvement to the parts of Iraq over which they have, at least for now, some authority.
Initially, when we arrived here, I mean, we used coalition money, and then, you know, at some point, you know, that ran out. And honestly, for a few months, I mean, we were really at a standstill. I couldn't get weapons. I couldn't get uniforms, patrol cars. I have a couple police stations that only have one patrol car.
To make matters worse, Baqaba is among the most dangerous police posts in all of Iraq. 2 days before we got here, suicide bombers struck two local police stations. 11 policemen and 5 civilians were killed. Immediately after the bombing, around 40 police officers in Baqaba province resigned. Grieg told us in early December that she'd been assured that money was on its way, but she says she lost valuable time.
We cannot really work on public works if we don't have the security to protect the workers that are there. We can ask all the contractors in the world to come out and build a sewage line and everything else. But you know what? Someone can come right behind them, throw a couple RPGs at it, and what do you have? We need the security first in order to allow these civilian contractors to get out to do their job.
an American lieutenant in a very tough spot in Iraq. Martin Smith, have you kept up with these commanders? Do they have resources flowing to them, or are they sitting there cooling their heels waiting for what?
Well, this period, it was critical. And Odierno, the general that was, you had a clip of him a little earlier, was talking about the same problem. This was in early October. They simply ran out of money. They were spending money that had been confiscated from the Baathists. Over $100 million were found in, you know, under beds and in closets of various of Saddam's people. And they were using that money as discretionary funds to fund small projects. And it was very effective in terms of winning people over because they were being spent on little things that people could actually see, whereas you can't really see the results of some of these big contracts of fixing an oil pipeline, let's say. So that money runs out, and now they go for 2 months in October and November. And during this period of time, violence increases dramatically. Mm-hmm. Some people, some officers believe there's a correlation, not just a coincidence there. And as of early December, finally, the $80 billion request, $19 billion of that was to go to Iraqi reconstruction, and that money started to flow in December. So what they lost was valuable time and people and people lost lives.
Jim is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. I think this is Jim Walsh from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great program. Quick questions for your wonderful guest, Martin.
Yes.
Have American forces found a balance between being aggressive enough to suppress the insurgency but not so aggressive that it alienates the local population? And do you see any difference between the way enlisted soldiers are reacting to what's happening on the ground versus the reservists, the regular folks who suddenly find themselves over there for a year-long period?
Jim, great questions. Our time is short, but let us pick them up. Martin Smith.
Yeah, I think finding that balance is critical, and I saw varying results and certainly some bad consequences. I mean, I've witnessed raids and I've witnessed arrests where people are clearly insensitive, really don't know how to operate as policemen. I've seen that as early as May, and I saw it again on this trip. As far as differences between the reservists and the enlisted, I'd say the higher up you go, the more understanding you get, the more perspective and sensitivity. I can't really comment on reservists versus enlisted because I wasn't always sure who I was with. But the officer corps I found very conscientious, and for the most part, there were exceptions. And as you went down the ranks, you got more insensitivity. You got very jittery, understandably, kids that, you know, you worry about them. They didn't have a soft touch. So finding that balance, very difficult thing to do. And the problem is that where there's a lot of resistance, they can't even run, they can't get NGOs in there, they can't get civil reconstruction teams working. And so they're at a standstill until they can get security, and then they have to be tough to get the security, and it's a catch-22 for them.
Martin Smith, how did you come away from this five-week drive across Iraq? And I guess having watched it since you left, how are you feeling right now? What's your level of optimism, pessimism?
Well, I agree
and
with
for what?
Well, yeah, for what? What's the goal here? The goal is to make it a better place than it was when we found it. And Iraqis are very angry at Americans. And picking up on Ed Wong, you were asking him at the beginning of the program what it was that was motivating this anger. And I'll add something else that I heard over and over again, and that is that America's a superpower. You guys could fix this country up if you just wanted to. You just don't want to spend the resources to fix this place up. And I say, I'm not so sure it's that simple. But they believe that. They see that we put a man on the moon. And so they figure if we're not fixing up Iraq in 2 months, since we're clearly capable of doing it, we're not doing it because of some conspiratorial reason that we want to keep them down. So they're very angry about that.
And
so that
whatever
that's
Americans
tough.
Might
Their
think of that, that's, it's very real, that perspective. Martin Smith, it's quite a trip with you, and we appreciate your making it. Thanks for reliving it with us tonight. Good luck with your show airing tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
Martin Smith, producer of the PBS Frontline documentary, Beyond Baghdad. It airs tomorrow night on public television stations across the country. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, President Bush's new proposal to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. This is On Point. In in what the White House billed as a major policy speech, President Bush today called for a renewed effort to stop the spread of nuclear and other weapons technology in a speech at the National Defense University in Washington. The president said efforts to combat proliferation have not been strong enough. One of his proposals was to prevent countries from acquiring the equipment and technology to enrich uranium and reprocess spent fuel for plutonium, even if the stated intent is to build civilian power facilities. Here's an excerpt from the president's speech.
In the past, enemies of America required mass armies, and great navies, powerful air forces to put our nation, our people, our friends at risk. In the Cold War, Americans lived under the threat of weapons of mass destruction, but believed that deterrence made those weapons a last resort. What has changed in the 21st century is that in the hands of terrorists, weapons of mass destruction would be a first resort, the preferred means to further their ideology of suicide and random murder. These terrible weapons are becoming easier to acquire, build, hide, and transport. Armed with a single vial of a biological agent or a single nuclear weapon, small groups of fanatics or failing states could gain the power to threaten great nations, threaten a world peace. America and the entire civilized world will face this threat for decades to come. We must confront the danger with open eyes and unbending purpose. I made clear to all the policy of this nation. America will not permit terrorists and dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most deadly weapons. Meeting this duty has required changes in thinking and strategy. Doctrines designed to contain empires, deter aggressive states, and defeat massed armies cannot fully protect us from this new threat. America faces the possibility of catastrophic attack from ballistic missiles armed with weapons of mass destruction. So that is why we are developing and deploying missile defenses to guard our people. The best intelligence is necessary to win the war on terror and to stop proliferation. So that is why I have established a commission that will examine our intelligence capabilities and recommend ways to improve and adapt them to detect new and emerging threats. We're determined to confront those threats at the source. We will stop these weapons from being acquired or built. We'll block them from being transferred. We'll prevent them from ever being used.
President Bush speaking earlier today at the National Defense University at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.